Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Most of us have had a job or two strictly for the paycheck, work that put food on the table but didn't add a lot of meaning to our lives. Many of us have also put in very hard work knowing it wouldn't earn us a dime, but was rewarding for other reasons, taking care of young children or elderly relatives, volunteering with an organization whose mission reflects our values. So what do surrogate mothers make of their arrangements? As women contracted to carry a pregnancy to term, then give that baby to intended parents who pay thousands of dollars for the work of pregnancy. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As my guest has discovered, surrogate mothers tend to view their arrangements as somehow different from either the pregnancies that gave them their own families, virtually all surrogates have already born children of their own, but also different from more traditional kinds of paid work. And their relationships to the people who pay them to be pregnant are also often much different than any other kind of employer-employee dynamic. Heather Jacobson is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington. Her new book is called Labor of Love, Gestational Surrogacy and the Work of Making Babies. Heather, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
You know that surrogacy has been practiced for a very long time, long before modern technology, but the ability for a woman to carry a pregnancy that was conceived outside of her body with somebody else's egg, that's a recent development.
It is, yeah. Gestational surrogacy, which most of the surrogacies today are, is a relatively new medical procedure. So surrogacy in which women were artificially inseminated with sperm from the intended father or from a sperm donor, that began in the 1970s. But it wasn't until IVF, in vitro fertilization procedures, really were developed that we were able to have gestational surrogacy. So our first gestational surrogacy in the United States, that was in the mid-1980s. So it really has only been a couple decades that we've been engaged in this large-scale social experiment, if you will.
What kind of people find themselves in a situation to hire a surrogate?
Sure. So about 12% of the U.S. Reproductive aged population experiences infertility. A small segment of that people are able to utilize infertility services in the United States. It is usually not covered by insurance, and it's a relatively expensive voyage. And so the people who hire gestational surrogates are usually people who have been on what I like to call the infertility train for a while. Usually surrogacy is not the first stop on that train. It's usually the end stop. And so these are people who have, many of them, been attempting to have a child utilizing assisted reproduction, many for years. There are some people, gay men and women, who know from the beginning of their reproductive voyage that they can't carry or bear a child. This might be their first stop, but for the majority of people, it is something that comes at the very end of a long process of attempting to have a child.
You used the word voyage a minute ago, and the language is very interesting here. This is commonly referred to as a journey, like the decision to hire a surrogate, the choice of a surrogate, the pregnancy, carry to term is referred to as a journey.
That's right. Yeah. And it's a journey not only for those who are attempting to have a child via surrogacy, but it is a journey for the surrogate as well.
I have to tell you, I was stunned at how little regulation there is of this. I really just assumed, because it is something that it's not so unusual now to hear of someone using a surrogate or being a surrogate. I just assumed there were laws to cover this in every state.
That's right. It's similar to a lot of other family law that is handled at the state level. For example, adoption is handled at the state level. Because surrogacy is relatively new, we have right now a situation in which some states have some regulation. Some states have some case law. Other states have nothing on the books. And so it really depends on what state the surrogate lives, in which the surrogate birth takes place, that the law will or will not cover that journey.
So there have to be arrangements made ahead of time about what will go on the birth certificate, for instance, because I would imagine the standard in law is that when a woman gives birth, she is automatically listed as the mother on that birth certificate.
That's correct. And so in some states, surrogates and intended parents are able to have what's called a pre-birth order. And that's a process by which the intended parent or parents file with the court to have their name go directly on the birth certificate at the birth of the child. In some states, for example, Texas, we're what's known as a surrogacy-friendly state in that we do have regulation. Very few states have, even those states that do have regulation, have enforcement. Right? There are only a few states that allow for the law to step in should something go awry with the procedure. So many surrogacies actually take place in this kind of gray legal space, and everyone involved, the surrogate, the intended parents, the surrogacy agency that's involved, the reproductive endocrinologist, the infertility doctor, everyone is just hoping that everything goes smoothly and it flies under the radar. But of course, we do have some cases in which that hasn't happened. Some pretty well-known cases that get a lot of media attention. And usually those cases have occurred in states in which there is little regulation, but sometimes they happen in states in which there is. For example, there's a case right now in California in which a surrogate gave birth to triplets and is now going to court. And California has really good surrogacy regulation in which the surrogate is going to court to seek custody of those children. It's a pretty rare. It gets a lot of media attention when that things like that do happen, but it's pretty rare in the world of surrogacy for that to happen.
How do women make the decision? Because unlike any other job you might take, this is one where you've got absolutely, you know, assuming the pregnancy goes to term, this is a commitment for the better part of a year at least.
That's right. That was one of the things when I first began this study. I originally was interested in what many people are interested in, what motivates women to be surrogates. And then I began talking with surrogates, and I was just floored by the amount of work that they engage in and the amount of time this takes, months, for some surrogates, years. One of the women that I profile in the book, she was engaged in attempting to be a surrogate for 3 years, cycling on the medication, going to the doctor's appointments, meeting with people before she actually became pregnant. So it takes a good deal of time. And so that really I was really struck by the dedication of surrogates to help people have children. And that then became my interest, not so much what motivates women to become surrogates, but the amount of work that they actually engage in.
People might look at this from a distance and say, well, they're making, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in some cases. But one of the women that you spoke with pointed out the fact that, you know, it's not so much when you consider how much time ultimately they are pregnant.
That's right. They put their bodies through a lot to become pregnant. Anyone who's been pregnant knows that. But surrogacy pregnancy is much more so than just a regular pregnancy, the work that's involved in a regular pregnancy. And so, yes, they put their bodies through a lot, and they spend a lot of time. Something that struck me, too, when I spoke to the women was the amount of work of being a surrogate requires that they have a really good support system. And so what I call in the book the surrogacy industry really relies on the surrogates to perform the labor, but also to have people in their lives that will help the surrogate to perform a lot of that extra work that comes from being a surrogate.
Are most of them partnered at the time they become surrogates?
Well, this is a really good question, Chris. And the reason why it's such a good question and as a researcher why it's such a frustrating question is because we have no federal data on surrogacy. Because it's not regulated, we have no national data.
So we don't know how many there are.
We don't know. We have estimates. We have good guesses. Right now, we estimate around 1,500 per year. Mm-hmm. So since the 1970s-ish, it's estimated somewhere between 10 to 31,000 surrogacy births in the United States. It's important to remember, though, those are births. Mm-hmm. Right. And many surrogates engage in multiple journeys and multiple attempts before they get pregnant. And then sometimes, as happened to quite a few of the women in my book, they have they experience a loss of a fetal death. And so those are the actual births. So it doesn't really represent all of the work that's involved, all of the numbers of surrogacies that occur per year.
How do would-be surrogates and intended parents find one another?
Right. So there's a variety of ways they do so. But right now, we think, and of course, too, because we don't have the national data. But from my research, as I understand it, the majority of women meet the intended parents through for-profit agencies. So there are many for-profit agencies. Some of them are housed within adoption agencies. Some of them are housed within lawyers' offices, or sometimes the infertility doctors themselves will make matches for people. Surrogates and intended parents also meet each other via various online forums or through, there's also surrogacies that happen among friends and family. And so there's a variety of ways that people meet, but today it's generally understood that a good deal of them occur through these for-profit surrogacy agencies that match people.
Do you surrogates, I'm going to make an assumption here, and please correct me if you know otherwise, but
sure.
It would seem that intended parents of surrogate children are particularly invested in having children that may be biologically related to one or both parents,
yes.
Because there are other options, mm-hmm. And this is not a criticism or a praise of anyone's choices, it's just the reality.
Right.
Do surrogates also share that sense that without biological relationships, they are not the mother of this child in the same way that, you know, other people might feel that if they'd given birth, this was their child in some fundamental way?
Yes, this is really central. This is the crux of surrogacy today. So in the original kind of surrogacy that we had beginning in the 1980s in the United States, it's what is known as traditional surrogacy. And that's where the surrogate was artificially inseminated with the sperm of the intended parent, with the intended father, or from a sperm donor.
So she's egg donor and surrogate at the same time.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so at that time, the surrogacy industry was very small. Many surrogates only engaged in surrogacy once. Some were paid, some were not. It was very ad hoc, right? So it's not the organized surrogacy that we have today. Today, most surrogates are gestational surrogates, and so they do not contribute their egg. So the embryo is created not using their gametes, whether it's both intended parents' egg and sperm, or an egg or sperm donor is used in the process. For most surrogates, it is not their egg. And that's a really important thing that drew many of the women in my study to surrogacy. Is that they really enjoyed being pregnant, loved being pregnant, but they didn't want another child. And many of them understood, kind of felt as if they did contribute their own egg, that would be their child. There, of course, are surrogates who today are still traditional surrogacy. Traditional surrogacy still occurs. And surrogates who are traditional surrogates have a different orientation, right? They, too, see the intentions of the parents as the important thing that determines whose child that is. But for many of the women in my study who were gestational surrogates, they told me that they could not have been a traditional surrogate and have donated their own egg. They were very quick to follow that up, however, by saying, but of course, there are women who, just as I just did,
right?
Of course, there are women who engage in traditional surrogacy and, you know, have a different orientation than I myself do.
We're speaking this hour with Heather Jacobson, who's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington. Her new book is called Labor of Love, Gestational Surrogacy and the Work of Making Babies. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Heather Jacobson, who's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington. Her new book is called Labor of Love, Gestational Surrogacy and the Work of Making Babies. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Heather, two different sets of parents and their doctors might have different choices in service to a healthy pregnancy. So maybe your doctor would tell you it's okay to have a cup of coffee every day. Mm-hmm. My doctor would say, don't do it. How often do intended parents have different expectations about what the pregnancy with their child carried by another woman? How often are those expectations different from what that woman did, say, with her first pregnancy with her own child?
That's a really important question, and something that's quite central that I found in my research, and that was the issue of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the surrogacy is going smoothly and the pregnancy is the fetal embryo transfer has gone well, the pregnancy is going well, the baby is developing, and no major issues have arisen, then in those participants in my study, this issue didn't really arise much. But I really heard this from people who an issue did arise, where there was something that was going awry with the pregnancy or with the medication, with the medical protocol in IVF. Many of the intended parents in my study and from the research we know who are utilizing a surrogate have themselves never experienced a pregnancy and so are new to this realm. Hmm. They have experienced, many of them, though, a great deal of disappointment and loss. So many of them are not expecting things to go well and don't have much hope. And many of the surrogates found that, part of their job as a surrogate was to bring hope to these people. But if an issue did arise, for example, I have one surrogate in my study, and another issue of an intended parent in which a medical issue with the developing baby and what was going on, and a decision had to be made about medicine, about how long to continue to take a medicine. And it was a very serious issue, and it really did impact the relationship that the couple had. Intended parents have to place a good deal of trust in someone else to carry their baby, and surrogates, too, have to place a good deal of trust in the medical professionals that they'll take good care of them, and in the intended parents that they'll follow through with all of the stipulations of the contract, that they'll take the baby in the end, actually.
Yeah.
Some surrogates are concerned, that, they didn't enter surrogacy to have another child. Surrogates were very quick to tell me if I wanted another baby, I would just have another baby. I have no problem, right, having babies. And they're very good at pregnancy and birth. So they don't enter surrogacy to have a child for themselves. Not at all. They enter surrogacy because of their love of being pregnant and because they want to help others. And I imagine we might get to talk into the financial aspects as well.
Well, I was fascinated that almost to a one, everybody who engages in this, the women who are engaging in this, they get paid, but they don't talk about that as being their motivation. But no one's turning down the paycheck.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, as I detail in the book, compensation is central to surrogacy. Compensation needs to be there. It's used as a recruitment tool to help recruit women to be surrogates. But we have a very uncomfortable relationship to compensation, to this mixture of family and the market, right? Now, I think it's important to remember that surrogacy is embedded within a huge market. It's embedded within the infertility market, right? And it's embedded within the reproductive market, right? So it's not only surrogacy that is, you know, is a commodity, right?
Well, it's interesting that you could contract with someone to buy a donor egg, right? And you can buy donor sperm, and you can rent the uterus of a woman to carry your child for you, but you may not buy a baby.
That's right. That's right. And legally, none of these things, I mean, egg donation is called donation, even though money exchanges hands and sperm donation and surrogacy. None of them, the buying and selling of children is illegal in every state.
Right.
In the nation. But yeah, it's but money does exchange hands. But we have this very uncomfortable relationship with it. And so much of my book details how the work of surrogacy and compensation itself is obscured. Surrogates are encouraged to think about the compensation they receive as a gift from the intended parents as and not as pay for the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people might, you know, women might look back on their own pregnancies and say, it was great, I enjoyed it, I felt healthy. But it is still, it takes time and energy away from other things that you might be doing. You found that a lot of surrogates do feel some pangs of guilt, you know, activities they're not doing with their own kids or, you know, activities with their husbands or partners. How do they process all that, and what does the money have to do with that guilt?
That's great, yes. So all of the women in my study, and all most surrogates, of course it's not regulated, so we can't say all, but we know that most surrogates themselves are mothers. You know, surrogates are required by surrogacy agencies. Most infertility doctors require surrogates to have given birth to a child themselves.
To demonstrate that they can carry a healthy pregnancy.
To demonstrate that they have what's called a quote-unquote proven uterus, right? That they can carry and birth a child. And also some argue so that they understand what motherhood is and so that they understand the child that they're carrying is not their child and so that they don't, you know, develop a bond or a kinship with that child. I'm sorry, what was the question?
We were talking about the work of surrogacy.
Yes.
And
So women are required to be mothers,
right?
And being a mother is part of the marketing strategy, right? Mm. It's what makes it's a demonstration of being a good mother is what helps to make one be a marketable surrogate, right? For the agencies, and yet the way the surrogacy industry is organized and the actual work of surrogacy requires them to be mothers, yet requires them to be able to easily extract themselves from their family lives in order to engage in all of this work. And so what I found was women surrogates feeling some guilt about this. I mean, it was guilt because of the time away from their family, because they weren't able to do what they normally do for their family, but also because they enjoy it so much. Hmm. And it becomes something that's not thought of as a regular work or a regular job, but it becomes a deep passion for many women. And they spend lots of time not only going to doctor's appointments and meeting with their intended parents and having medical procedures done, but also contacting other surrogates and being engaged in the social aspect of surrogacy. And so they felt guilt because of that pleasure. Many women many women in our society, I believe, are placed in positions of feeling guilt for not only their work, but especially if they enjoy their work,
right?
And enjoy their hobbies and the time that takes them away, or that times that it's understood to take them away from their families. And so compensation, what I found many of the women in my study doing with their compensation was not spending it on themselves, but spending it on their families.
So they'll plan like a trip to Disney World or say, well, this will pay for the new minivan, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. They'll pay off the car note. They'll pay off a credit card. Many of the women in my study engaged in surrogacy more than once or had plans to engage in it more than once. So many would pay off the credit cards with the first surrogacy. And then in the second surrogacy, you'd take a trip to Disneyland or put money aside for their kids' college. Their college funds.
Do first-time surrogates worry at all? First-time surrogates who have a child of their own, do they worry at all that they will have trouble letting go of that child, despite the legal documentation that would,
right.
would prevent that from happening? But do they worry about their emotional state after giving birth?
Right. I think that the women in my study, they didn't speak about that so much. I think it's a self-selection effect. Mm-hmm. I think women that would have that as a serious concern, and some surrogacy agencies require women to meet with a counselor and to talk about these types of things. I think women that had that as a serious concern wouldn't be a surrogate. Mm-hmm. Most all of the women in my study, you know, would show me a picture or a video of when they handed over the baby to the intended parents, and they said to me, "This is why I do surrogacy, because I get to do this." And I get to see the joy that it brought to the intended parents' face. And it was really that most of the women were seeking. Most didn't speak to me about concerns they had, of fears that they had about not being able to go through with it. But again, it doesn't mean that they didn't experience them. They just didn't talk about them to a researcher. And it might be because there's a very strong socialization effect in the surrogacy community. Right. That's something that's a primary fear that a lot of intended parents have, that the surrogate will become attached to the child and not want to release the child to them, especially if the surrogacy is occurring in a state in which there's no regulation, or in a state in which there is some regulation, but the surrogate is deemed the mother, the legal mother. So they didn't talk to me about that too much.
So I was interested when you mentioned earlier that surrogates really need a support system mm-hmm. at home and, you know, with friends and family. I think those of us who have carried children remember, you know, those of us who are fortunate had a supportive partner who ran out for ice cream or who drove us to an appointment, that sort of thing. Not everyone is that lucky, but it seems like a lot to ask of a partner who is not going to end this process with a child, which is not to say that it's a woman's job to provide children all the time for men. But how do their partners, are they mostly male partners that these surrogates have? Are there lesbians who perform surrogacy that
there
you
are.
Interviewed?
Mm-hmm. I didn't interview any lesbians, mm-hmm. But there are lesbians who act as surrogates, and there are surrogates who act as surrogates for lesbians. Mm-hmm. But the majority of the women in my study were married. We're involved in a heterosexual marriage and had partners. Some of them had to do some convincing of their husbands or their partners. And I interviewed husbands and partners and adult children and mothers-in-law and mothers as well for this study. Some of the men told me that quite a few of the men told me that they knew how much their wives loved being pregnant and how happy their wives were when they were pregnant, and that things sometimes in the home that they enjoyed their wives being pregnant. Some of the men saw it. Some of the men talked about allowing their wives to be surrogates. Some of the surrogates did use compensation as an enticement for their husbands to agree. If a woman is legally married, most agencies require her husband to agree to the surrogacy as well. So it's not just about relations within the home, but for many women, in order to be a surrogate through a surrogacy agency, their husband or their legal partner needs to agree. And that, of course, is because if anything had happened with the arrangement and the husband of a surrogate decided that he wanted to be the legal father of the child, right? It can get very complicated if he hasn't agreed as well. And so he's required to sign contracts as well.
What happens if something goes wrong with the pregnancy? You mentioned that mm-hmm. some pregnancies don't go to term and babies die. But what happens if a baby is born but is not sort of the healthy, perfect child? I'm using quotation marks here.
Right.
That intended parents thought they were going to get.
Right. And that happens regardless of how a pregnancy occurs, right? And so some of the same things that can happen with any birth can happen in surrogacy. If a parent child decides not to parent their legal child, then of course social services will get involved. But it does get complicated with surrogacy, especially if it happens in a state in which there is not regulation like we have here in Texas. And in that case, there's we've had some cases in the United States where a child is in this kind of legal limbo, right? It depends on the state. I mean, in some states, the surrogate's name goes on the birth certificate if a pre-birth order has not been filed or is not possible. And then an adoption has to occur. A second parent adoption has to occur. And so, you know, we have had some cases. I had one surrogacy director tell me about a case in which a child was born through a surrogacy and the intended parents decided that they did not want to parent the child. And then the surrogacy agency stepped in to help find an adoptive placement for that child. But again, surrogates, you know, we do have some cases around the globe and here in the United States where a surrogate might take legal custody of the child. But again, that's not surrogate's intentions.
So Heather, surrogates, presumably, in addition to their other motivations, want and need the money. Mm-hmm. Intended parents, mm-hmm. in addition to their other motivations or resources, have the money to pay for a surrogacy, which is, you know, presumably as expensive or more expensive out of pocket than a lot of other ways to have a child. Is there class tension between surrogates and these people paying them for the use of their wombs?
Right. Now, this is something that's kind of been central since the 1980s in a lot of the media on surrogacy. You might be familiar with in the New York Times a couple years ago, there was a big Her Body, My Baby article where it showed a surrogate sitting on the porch of her what looked to be a middle class home. And then the surrogate mother was standing on a very manicured lawn, a very large home with a baby nurse standing at attention, kind of highlighting some of these seemingly class tensions that are inherent in surrogacy. What I found was that some of the surrogates did tell me that they would never have met their intended parents were it not for surrogacy because they circulate in very different social circles. I did have some surrogates that was not the case, that they did kind of operate in the same social circles. I had surrogates who, some surrogates in my study had a family income of less than $50,000 a year. Others had a family income of more than $150,000 per year. So it's not always, but again, we don't have the federal data to know.
We're speaking this hour with Heather Jacobson, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington, about her new book, Labor of Love, Gestational Surrogacy and the Work of Making Babies. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Heather Jacobson, Associate Professor of Sociology at UTA. Her new book is called Labor of Love, Gestational Surrogacy and the Work of Making Babies. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So whether things go really smoothly or not, for the period of the pregnancy, there is a lot of contact, I would imagine, between mm-hmm. the intended parents and the surrogate. How often does that just come to an abrupt end after delivery, and how do surrogates feel about that?
Right. So most of the women who I interviewed wanted to engage in surrogacy because they wanted to experience a pregnancy again. But part of the way that surrogacy is organized in the United States is that intended parents and surrogates have contact with each other. In the early days of surrogacy in the United States, that wasn't always the case. We had closed programs where surrogates and intended parents did not know the identity of each other, much like an adoption. Mm-hmm. But things today are much more open, and surrogates and intended parents do. I had some pairings of surrogates and intended parents who spent a good deal of time together. Their families spent time together following the birth of the surrogate child. They continue to be involved in the life of the child. Many surrogates actually wanted that or sought that out or found that to be a very special part of being a surrogate. Some agencies require the intended parents to have contact with the surrogate to send pictures and photographs, you know, for a period of time afterwards. I found that the more a surrogate was involved in surrogacy, as the number of journeys she was involved in increased, the more, I would say, understanding she was about the complexity of the family's lives, right? So I had many women in my study that said, oh, I would love to see them, or, you know, I would love to take a trip and be able to see the baby, or I hope they're able to visit again, but I understand they have newborns to take care of, or, you know, their family is so complex now. Most of the intended parents that I spoke to were appreciated that. It seems like a couple of the families in my study remained close and saw each other often and became close friends. Many others, though, continued to have very congenial relations with each other. Many of them didn't live, though, in the neighborhood, the town, the region, the state, mm-hmm. As their intended parents. So contact varied from the groups, but it seems like for most of them, contact was not abruptly cut off. I did have a couple surrogates in my study that was the case, and that was quite hurtful to them.
I know that your focus was on surrogates and not on intended parents, but I wonder if you got even a sense of, for intended parents, for the mothers, if they were using a surrogate because they hadn't been able to successfully carry a pregnancy to term, if they had ambivalent feelings about someone else, they get their beautiful baby, but someone else had the experience that we really kind of reify in our culture and make it seem like you're not a real woman unless you have given birth, which I think a lot of people disagree with, but many women are made to feel that way.
That's right. I think it might be even more particularly painful or acute for women who do hire a surrogate in that the majority of them have been attempting themselves to be pregnant for years and years. That's not always the case, of course, but some of the intended parents that I spoke to, that was the case. But also perhaps because of that, because they had invested so much and attempted to become pregnant so much, at the end, some of the intended parents I spoke to, some of the intended mothers said, you know, I really had wanted to carry a pregnancy myself, but I had to decide, did I want to continue to attempt IVF on myself or did I want to be a mother? And I made this choice and I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And that doesn't, of course, mean that they don't have ambivalent feelings. And some of the surrogates spoke to me about that, that they're, you know, that they were particularly sensitive to the any awkwardness that might exist with their intended mother.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Nick on the line in Dallas. Hi, Nick.
Hi there. I had a general question regarding if during your research for the book, if you came across any information about the legality of payment for gestation services, but the illegality of being able to buy a transplant organ in this country across all states.
That's a great question, Nick. Yes, and surrogacy is often thought of, and different researchers try and examine surrogacy in that same context, thinking about you know, the very interesting and kind of sordid history we have in terms of organ donation and blood and plasma, for example, right? You can get paid to donate plasma, but not to donate blood, you know, and how that varies. So some people who, some opponents of surrogacy argue that this should be outlawed just as organ donation payment for organs is outlawed. But of course, that too is a very interesting and fascinating history.
In Europe, you're not allowed to pay a surrogate, is that right?
That's right. And it varies from country to country in terms of what the restrictions are. But there are many places around the globe, and most places around the globe, that do have regulation on surrogacy. It is illegal to commercialize surrogacy. Of course, there are surrogacies that occur that are traditional surrogacies that involve perhaps very little medical intervention. Commercial surrogacy is outlawed in many places around the globe. And so many people do come to the United States. The United States is the epicenter for surrogacy in the world. And with the recent closing of India for surrogacy that was in the fall of this academic year, India closed to foreign intended parents. So many people who, you know, were looking to India for surrogacy might perhaps now be looking to the United States or other places around the globe.
Traditionally, when a woman has a child or two and becomes pregnant again, there's a story, you know, there's a version of the same story that we tell older brothers and sisters. How do surrogate mothers explain this to their children when the baby in their belly is not going to be their little brother or sister?
Right. And that really depends on the age of the children. Mm-hmm. Surrogates, attempt to communicate that information in an age-appropriate way. But one interesting thing I found was that many surrogates were a little bit maybe caught off guard, or that being a surrogate made the quote unquote bees, the birds and the bees talk, talking about sex and where babies come from happen earlier in their family's lives than they had anticipated it.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the surrogates in my study, the woman who had been a surrogate for 3 years before she actually got pregnant, she said, you know, my children think that you get pregnant by taking shots and going to the doctor. And so, you know, for many, assisted reproduction, for many of these children, assisted reproduction is naturalized within their homes and is an understood way to get pregnant. And so it's kind of a little bit of a backwards conversation, but having to have that discussion. But that was a very important issue for the surrogates in my study, was making sure that their children fully understood that these were not their siblings that she would be bearing.
And of course, there's also people that you might know casually, you know, on the playground, at church or at the synagogue or wherever you hang out, who see you pregnant and maybe don't know you but assume, oh, you know, Sally is having a baby, and the next time I see her, she'll be cradling a baby.
That's right. Just reminded me of one of the women in my study who, in her neighborhood, there she had a neighbor that she wasn't really good friends with, but kind of a casual, just waving in the driveway kind of neighbor. And she had been engaged in surrogacy quite a few times. And she said, he just keeps on seeing me being pregnant and not having a baby over and over and over, right? I think she had, you know, maybe 3 or 4 surrogacy pregnancies. And so she's like, maybe I need to go explain it to him what's going on.
Are there awkward conversations when people say, when are you due? And, you know, you see someone pregnant, mm-hmm. and the assumption is that that is their baby.
That's right. And it really depends. Many of the women in my study told me it really depended upon in what context that conversation took place. Mm-hmm. If it was someone in their church that they were friendly with, that they would see often, then they often would have a conversation and explain it. If it just happened in the grocery store and, you know, the clerk asked, you know, what are you having? They just said, a boy. Right. Or a girl, and would go on. So it really depended. But some surrogates, and especially their husbands or their partners that I spoke to, some of them like to kind of play with it a little bit in public. And someone would say, when is your baby due? And, you know, the surrogate would say, well, it's not my baby. And the husband would pop over and say, and it's not mine either. Right? Things like that.
More than one of the women that you interviewed spoke about encounters where someone said to them, well, it's nice that you can do this and give a baby away, but I could never do that, which is like so passive aggressive.
Yes.
And yet maybe it speaks to a place of honesty from people who, you know, blurt this sort of thing out.
Right. And I think what's inherent in that is the assumption that the babies that surrogates are carrying are theirs. Mm-hmm. Now, surrogates have a very different conception of it, and the surrogacy industry does, the intended parents do, because kind of going back to earlier what we were talking about, the genetics of the child. In surrogacy today, in gestational surrogacy, you know, and in the larger American society, you know, an understanding of whose child is whose child, right, is dependent upon where the genetics come from. Now, that, of course, is not always the case. We have lots of families in which there are deep, abiding parental-child relationships that are not based in genetics. Adoption is one great example of that. For surrogates, they very much understand the child not to be theirs. And so when someone says to them, oh, it's great that you can give away your baby, but I could never do that, many surrogates retort with, well, it's not my baby, right? I'm giving the baby back to its parents. I'm just holding on to it for 9 months, right? It's pre-birth child care is a term that came up, right? This is just pre-birth child care. And then I'm returning the baby to its rightful parents.
I know that you are a sociologist and not a legal scholar, but having looked at this, are there ways that you think we could effectively, if there were to be a national standard, what kinds of things should every state think about doing to make the best possible experience for intended parents and for surrogates and for the children that together they will bring into the world?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a hard question, too. I think some of the things that some really well-established, reputable agencies are doing now are things that the agencies and people who are involved, medical practitioners, lawyers, and agency directors, argue should be the case for all surrogacies. Having a good screening for people. Surrogacy is an expensive process. And so it's important that, the women who are surrogates are able to carry children. One of the other it's not a legal rule, but it's a rule of many of the practice is that most agencies will not hire women who are on welfare to act as surrogates.
The assumption being that they might be coerced somehow,
right? Yeah, that the money, the quote unquote proper motivations of women to act as surrogates is something that's really important to the industry. It's important for a couple different reasons, but one is the image of surrogacy. We've had a couple pretty high profile cases over the course of the last 30 years that have really and movies and TV shows and I mean the numbers of surrogacies that occur per year is minute compared to the number of births that occur per year. And yet there is this societal fascination with surrogacy. The rules that we could have or the legal rules that could govern or some of the things that are already occurring. But this is a much it's a small phenomenon, but it touches on so many important things. I mean, the federal government has gone really nowhere near surrogacy. One, it's an industry. It's an emerging industry. And our laissez-faire ideas about industrial expansion. But also, it really touches on some very deep moral and religious issues. Part of that, I think, would be the job of legal scholars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Heather Jacobson is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington. Her new book is called Labor of Love, Gestational Surrogacy and the Work of Making Babies. Heather, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.